I'm David Schreiner Kahn, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Todd Heslin. Todd is an Australian entrepreneur and angel investor. His current work is focused on helping businesses identify and deeply understand their best customers. Todd, welcome to the show.
David, it's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on. So, Todd, in your experience, have you seen business growth as something that is smooth and linear, or do you see it as something that is much more erratic?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, it depends on the resolution on how, when you're looking at growth, at what resolution you are actually focused on. So if we kind of take an analogy of, say, any type of sort of growth chart, and you know, you see a lot of these as an angel investor, people giving you growth charts, but you see things that look like they're going up, and they're going up really, you know, erratic growth. But if you kind of take the resolution back and you step back to say, well, what does that look like over 10 years or 25 years? Or you go forward, you say, what does that look like in 3 months? You have a completely different picture. And I find that really interesting, because this is the balance between something that can look kind of linear on the outside, can be incredibly erratic on the inside. And in more practically speaking, you can look at a competitor's business, or you can look at a colleague or someone else who you've worked with in the past, and it seems that everything looks linear, and then in your case, it can be really erratic, and you feel like something is wrong. But in my experience, the people who react to that and they fight the sort of the ups and downs on a daily basis with their own emotional input, they end up making it worse than better. So I think that there's no kind of, in terms of linear or sort of the erratic sort of growth, I think this very much comes down to your perspective. And although you may feel like you are kind of smooth, you know, going along relatively smooth, or you're in a period of going up and down, either way, it's probably somewhere in between. And I think that your mindset totally reflects how you perceive that particular growth.
So how does this come into play? Would you be willing to share an example from your own business experience?
Yeah, absolutely. Would love to. So I can think of a really good one was my first business, which I started 10 years ago and still exists today. We had what felt like at the time, you know, we would have months where we were, you know, essentially weeks away from bankruptcy, and they would have months where we were absolutely flush and we were growing our customer acquisition rate, and our delivery rate was way above what we expected we could do. And it was literally erratic. Like, it was something where we just couldn't understand how we could grow so fast and then feel like we're about to go bankrupt. And then this just repeated itself back and forth. Now, when I look at it from where I am, you know, sort of 10 years down the track, it seemed relatively smooth. Like, we were very reactionary to what we were doing. But year on year, we actually were growing quite well. And it's just that feeling that when you're in the thick of it, it comes to a very personal sort of emotional connection to you. And where I made my biggest mistakes was where I was reacting to that, as opposed to kind of just understanding the cycle of that growth.
So how would you have reacted differently in the moment, particularly at the times when cash flow was really tight?
How did I act, or how would I act?
How would you have acted differently if...
differently.
Right? Because what you're saying is a lot of this has to do with how you react emotionally when you're in the trenches.
How would I act differently? When I was in the trenches, as you say, I still do it today. I know I do. I get very caught up in the you know, I think the simplest way to say it is it's that balance between important and urgent, right? I could probably describe it differently, but that really is what it is. It is just focusing too much on what is urgent and not on what is important. And why did we make it through and not go bankrupt? Well, that would have been because there was some part of my consciousness that focused on the important things, and that got us through. But all the hell that we went through would have been focusing on urgent.
Yeah, I've seen this many times where businesses, particularly when it comes to cash flow issues, the company, just like you've described, the company might be growing, but might also be facing a short-term cash deficit. And that's the kind of situation where it can literally kill a business, right? So one of the conversations, absolutely, one of the conversations, as an example, that I will typically have with clients is, what would you do if you got an order that would increase your business by 50%? And
yep,
right. And most people get very excited when they think about that possibility. Yeah,
I bet.
But the truth is, if you don't have the infrastructure to support rapid growth, you may not be able to deliver on the promise to your customers.
And then, yes, but you've touched on something really important there, David. Sorry to interrupt.
No, and then you're scrambling to try to make good on a promise, and you may, yes, not be able to do things in the most cost-effective way because you're making decisions really quickly.
Right. So you also mentioned that, you know, there's this prospect of growth, and you know, this does happen to us, and happened to me quite a few times, where we would receive, we'd bring on some new clients, and they'd be pretty significant to us. They'd be sort of 20 to 30, 40% of our annual budget was, or what we're trying to grow to. And that got us really excited. The downfall that we had is that, particularly with the type of business that I was running, which was a predominantly consulting business at that time. We did change that. We can talk about that after. You have these fixed sort of ratcheting of costs where it's like, well, we need to service these clients, so we're going to need to go and hire more people, and we need to go invest in this other technology. And that ends up sticking with you. So when things start to turn back around, just in the ebbs and flows of the cycle, you end up with this higher cost structure that puts enormous pressure on just what used to be the normal day to day.
Right. And then you're again battling the important versus the urgent.
Yeah, exactly. And that emergency mode that we go into is the most destructive for growth. When you're in the mindset of, I have to do anything it takes to survive. People think that survival instinct is what creates success. And I completely disagree with that, because the survival mindset is inherently a scarcity mindset, and you lose so much of that potential where you're looking for the growth opportunities, but then you're evaluating them objectively, not subjectively.
So Todd, with that concept in mind, why don't you take us through a little bit of your business history and talk about how you've made some shifts that have really put you in a spot where you're able to take a very different approach that has had a positive impact.
Yeah, I would love to. So my the kind of core of my career, the one thing that kind of worked really well for me has been the business I started when I finished my corporate consulting career at Ernst & Young. I was in corporate finance there, and I just wanted a change. And we started a business that is consulting in the energy efficiency space, particularly for industrial companies. So we'll basically help industrial companies reduce their energy consumption, and it would save them a bunch of money. But it was all consulting. It was all service delivery work. Now, as we grew, we did have this case where we got some pretty decent clients and some decent contracts, and then we expanded our team. But we ultimately got to the point where the entire business operation was focused on me and I had a business partner, but it was still very much focused on me, from myself doing all the sales and then sort of leading the delivery as well. I got to the point where I actually got sick in 1 week. I can't even remember which year this was, but the entire business stopped because no one knew what to do when I wasn't around. And I realized that this was a beast that I built that really was going to eat me alive, because I was going to drive myself into the ground. So I made a choice at that point that I was actually going to be stepping out of the business. And I told everyone that I was booking a plane ticket, and I did. And I think it was about 5 months later, I was out of the country and everyone was on their own, and it was kind of sink or swim for them. But then consequently, 5 years later, the business has kept running, and they've sort of done it without me, and I've kind of turned it into a passive income business. After that, I've been involved with starting other companies, which have been completely different in a completely different industry. But the bulk of my experience where I've sort of dealt with these problems has been from that era.
So would you say that most entrepreneurs should think about their own business strategy as needing for the business to be able to carry on without the entrepreneur being present, or without the founder being present?
Look, I think there's no golden rule here, because that inherently comes with an overhead, and this is the, you know, in terms of one piece of advice specifically about this that I think really has to carry, is that you have to make these decisions with your own personal intent in mind. It can't be because you heard Todd say this on a podcast, or you heard Seth Godin say this in his books or his writing. I mean, you really have to think about the life you want to live and then decide if that's important to you or not. Because in many cases, more growth is not necessarily conducive with other goals you may have in life. And, you know, there's obviously a structural advantage to an organization when everything isn't focused on the founder, or the CEO or director or owner, who, you know, sort of whoever's sort of running the ship. But at the same time, the process to strengthen the organization can be a lot of work, and it's not always necessarily worth it, depending on where you want to take that business and what you want to do internally.
This is a very important message for our listeners, that you've got to have your personal goals clear before you decide what kind of business strategy you need to have in order to meet those personal goals.
I made the mistake, David, that I thought that was selfish when I was doing this. I thought that if I molded myself around the business, I was being what a true business person and a true entrepreneur should be. And that's wrong. I think it's wrong because it puts you in the wrong mindset, because you become so defensive of your decisions because you think that everything you've made has been, you know, blessed with the sort of gold around it. And it's just not true, is that we make good decisions and bad decisions. But if you're not clear about what you want, then you can never personally say, is this right for me or not?
That's so true, Todd. That's so true. What kinds of mistakes have you seen? Because I know you're an angel investor as well. What kinds of mistakes have you seen other business owners make, where there's a conflict between their personal goals and their what they try to create with their businesses?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I don't hear enough people asking this question. Whenever I'm sitting down with a founder, I always ask them, why are they building this? And invariably they have no idea what I mean. But I have to kind of explain a bit more, is that, you know, when you're building a business, you either building it to sell it, you're building it because you want cash flow coming back, you're building it because you want to have a job and you want to basically work and you're happy to do the hours, you just don't want anyone else to be your boss, or you're building it as pure passive income where the sole objective is limited work and highest effective hourly output. And in many cases, this can sound like it's a very startup sort of concept, but it really applies to businesses that are quite mature, that are facing a point in their industry where they have to make a choice, they have to change. And I think the people that actually need to go through this thought process, of course, sort of startups need to, but when you're someone, when you're in an industry where everything is changing at your feet, and you have to make a proactive move so that you solidify your place in the market, you should be asking the same questions that a startup is asking when they're entering that same market or they're entering another market. Because the same things that apply. Now, the problems that I've seen have been where a founder has started a business with one intent and they really want something else. And the two that always seem at ends are when you want to sell the business and when you want to make the business passive income. And it kind of sounds a little bit counterintuitive, because the common logic is, well, if it's passive income, then the business works without me, so it's great, I can sell it. But the problem with that is that structurally, the decisions you make as you're building this business, whether it is for sale down the track, or it is to be be a little servant to serve you, are fundamentally different, and they're never really going to align. It's going to be almost impossible to turn one business into another.
What are some of the differences between designing a business for sale versus designing a business for passive income?
Yeah, good question. So this does depend on the type of business it is. But I can give you two examples. There are a lot of businesses that are for passive income, but they're still very much tied up with the brand of the founder. And I can give you one example. This is a guy, is a friend of mine, and has a very successful online business. His name's Pat Flynn. He runs smartpassiveincome.com, and effectively, the business is a very healthy business. He publishes his income online. The biggest problem with Pat's business is it's all about Pat. And if Pat doesn't show up, the audience isn't there. And in his case, he can't sell his business. Even though it's generating a lot of money for him, and he has something which is effectively he doesn't need to work on anymore, but he does. He can't sell that because it's not worth it. People are there for Pat. They're not there for anyone else. Now, that's because he's designed the business to be about him, yet still, with minimal amount of input. The other side is that you have founders, and this is really, really common, founders that don't do the hard work of working out their business model early and finding their product market fit early. What ends up happening is they run out of money, and because they don't want to suffer themselves, they will go and get an investor. And the investor will come in, and the moment the investor comes in, you're pretty much saying, I'm going to sell this business at some point in time, because the investor has to get the money back. And they don't realize this. So a year down the track, they think, well, I want to turn this into a passive business, a passive income business now. Unfortunately, they've got investors who are thinking otherwise because they want to get their investment back. And this happens way too often, where entrepreneurs who have either a small business or they have a larger business and they have to raise some money because they have to do a restructure, they take in outside money, but then they lose that ability to say, hey, this isn't about me anymore. I'm going to make the business run without me as a founder.
It's interesting. Did you think that business owners and investors don't have that key conversation often enough about what it means once outside investors are part of the business?
Yeah. I think that we get so caught up in the romanticism of investment and, you know, what people see on Shark Tank and everything else, but they don't get to the structural conversation, which is maybe you don't need an investor. Maybe you just need a really good business coach who is going to help you find that growth you need such that you can bring the customers in that will fund that growth for you. Maybe you need someone who can talk strategy and work out a way that you can pre-fund some of that growth as opposed to taking outside money. Or perhaps you want to have a conversation with an investor and say, you know what, I actually don't want to have you as an investor, but we could do some sort of royalty deal where if you can lend me this money, I'll pay it back and then you get a royalty going forward for whatever it is. And that ends up being a lot more favorable because you don't have someone on your back saying, hey, we have to sell this thing because I want to get my investment back. And yeah, you're right. The conversations just don't happen because we think there's a way that the investment should be and we don't challenge that.
Yeah. And if you have investors, you're losing control. You're giving, or certainly you're giving some up.
Yeah, this is an interesting one because the concept of control, I always thought this was about control in decision making. Like, you know, you want to enter a new market or you want to, expand the team or you want to develop a new product, and therefore your investors will have some sort of influence and control on those decisions. But what I now know is that the control you're really giving up is the opportunity to switch, the opportunity to change, the opportunity to say, you know what, we have, 20 staff, but we're going to change our team, we're going to change our business model, and we're going to have a team of 5, and I'm going to work, 10 hours in the week. You can't do that when you have investors, because typically they have to make their capital back. Unless you're a very profitable business where you're paying such a healthy dividend that, you're low risk and a high yield for them, so they don't really care, which is very uncommon. They're going to need you to sell the business. So that's the sort of control that you give over, and no one really thinks about that. Well, very few people think about this.
Yeah, that's so true. That's a great point. Todd, I wonder if we can go back to something you mentioned earlier about passive income. And and the question I have is passive income really passive? Particularly if it's like in the case you mentioned where the personality of the business leader is so critical to the business having income.
Yeah. Look, it's funny you ask that question because most of the people who I know who have been very successful in building passive income are the hardest working people that I know. they don't sit on the beach all year and collect their checks as they come in. They get back to work. And I think that there's an illusion that passive income is this thing that will provide freedom and risk-free cash flow. And I think that this is a critical mistake a lot of people make. And I really challenge your audience is that if you're thinking, hey, passive income sounds good, that you go through that thought process and say, what do I expect that it's actually going to give me? And be really brutally honest, because what you'll discover is that it's very common that there's a sense of, I have a very choppy, erratic business where I've got clients paying sometimes, I've got product recalls, or I've got products going in and out. It just feels like everything's out of control. But this idea of passive income is like, oh, it's great. It would just be a constant cash flow coming in. It's almost like a salary for the entire business. And that's the illusion that is kind of tied to it. But the reality is that when you build something like that, when you have a passive income source, the only thing it really provides you is the choice to make the next decision not based on your last decision. And what I mean by that is that you inherently get caught, or we all do, we get caught in this cycle of the sort of relying on our past success to define what our future success will be. So we've seen what we've done well in the past, and we think that this model is working, so we're going to do more of it. When you have something which is income producing and completely separated from your natural talent and decision making, because it essentially is passive income, you now have the opportunity, if you choose to take it, to say, you know what, I'm going to do something different, or we're going to try something new that's completely different from our income source. And that in itself is a completely different kind of mindset of business, as opposed to just in the trenches, looking at what we did last month, trying to improve on that, look what we did last year, trying to double it for this year, or whatever that case may be.
Right. But though even I've seen people who have so-called passive income businesses, where it's particularly a service business where you've taken your offering and you have productized the services. So you're delivering the service, but it's in an asynchronous mode where you're not delivering it face-to-face all the time. So it doesn't require you to be present face-to-face live with customers in order to get paid. But if you're doing that, you still have to create more product unless your product is truly evergreen and people will always want to buy it without any changes.
True. I'll add another one there, David, is that this happened for our business. So before I actually left and become a sort of passive founder without sort of day-to-day input, we were, as I said, a service-based company. We were consulting. We charged an hourly rate for our work. We would go out, we would win a client, and would say, this is how many hours, this is our hourly rate, this is how much we're going to charge, which is a terrible model. I hate it. But that's what we were doing. The one thing that we did that created a passive income stream, actually, and I won't say it wasn't necessarily passive, but it was decoupling our time as an organization, was that there was an opportunity for us to create value outside of our time. And for our industry, that was creating essentially these carbon certificates for the work that we were doing. So instead of just going out and giving advice, we could go out and we could make some changes and we could create these certificates, and then we could share in that revenue after we sold those certificates with our clients. Now, by creating a decoupling of time to value creation, you inherently put yourself in a case where you can make those choices around how you want to spend that time or what resources you need to do that. But it's not necessarily about just creating a product. You can kind of find other sources of value that are not linked to time that look very similar to passive income.
That's true. And that could be a topic for a whole other podcast.
Totally.
So Todd, could you fill us in a little bit on what you're doing now in your business and what we have to look forward to from you in the near future?
Yeah, sure. So the business that I have been speaking of, the one that I've had for the last 10 years, I have actually agreed with one of my employees, one of the guys who has been working the whole time. He is going to buy that off me. That's kind of a nice to be able to kind of complete that circle, and he's going to take it over and he's going to run it the way he wants to run it, which is fantastic. So it served me well over this time. The work that I'm doing now is really interesting. So I didn't kind of get into the second part of my story, which was the investing and some of the other startups that I have been involved in, and some interesting stories in there. But I've sort of taken a bit of a backseat at the moment, and I'm very much focusing on customer lifetime value and what this concept means. Sort of my technical sort of chops there is within the data analytics field, but I'm very fascinated with how companies are valuing their customers, but then not just as a total group, but actual segments of those customers, and which customers inherently have greater value than other customers. So I'm doing a lot of work with a few private clients on that at the moment, and I hopefully should be publishing some insights to kind of update everyone else as I normally do. I try to keep relatively public, and that should be relatively soon.
Sounds good. So we're going to look forward to that. Todd, is there someone you know personally who is doing really remarkable work that you'd like to mention?
Yeah, there is. And I mentioned him in the interview already, and that's Pat Flynn from smartpassiveincome.com. I've known Pat since I interviewed him on my podcast I did about 3 years back, I think it was. And he runs a really successful business. He posts his income online, but I'm pretty sure it's sort of $90,000 to $100,000 a month, and it's kind of just him, and he's got a small team. The thing that really impresses me about what Pat's doing at the moment is he is taking the hard look at understanding his audience and understanding effectively or treating his audience as customers. And this is kind of just something interesting because we kind of classify our, whether it's an audience or customers or clients, we kind of call them names, but we kind of silo and box them. But Pat's taking an approach where he's looking to really understand individual characteristics of his audience and effectively segment that audience in hundreds of different ways so that he can serve them better in terms of the content he produces and how he interacts with them from a product perspective as well. I really admire him doing that because the easy route is to just go down advertising and just say, hey, I'm just going to serve ads to, you know, hundreds of thousands of people every day, and that's going to make me money. But he's doing the hard work to actually treat people like people, and I respect that.
Yeah, I'm a big follower of Pat Flynn as well, and I would agree he does the hard work, and I have great respect and admiration for everything he's accomplished, and his work is often very cutting edge.
It is, yeah, totally.
Todd, how can our listeners learn more about you?
Well, I think I only put this up a few days ago, but on my blog, which is beingremarkable.me, so beingremarkable.me, I have a page called a Now page. So if you go to beingremarkable.me/now, you'll see exactly what I'm doing now. And this was inspired by Derek Sivers at sivers.org. He kind of did this thing about a Now page just being this place where people can go and see what you're doing now, which is kind of different to an About page, which is kind of about you and your past. But yeah, if you go to beingremarkable.me/now, you'll see kind of what I'm working on, and you can navigate to other interesting things I'm doing on my blog there.
Sounds good. We will encourage listeners to check it out. Well, yeah, Todd, this has been a really interesting discussion about business growth, different types of business models, business strategy, how your emotions can often get in the way of making good decisions, and a whole range of conversation.
Yeah, it could have been four times as long, I think.
Yes, so we'll have to do this again.
I would love to.
Yeah, so Todd, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Smashing the Plateau. My guest today has been entrepreneur and angel investor Todd Heslin. Thank you again, Todd, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on.